set.
The Antioch Podcast.
A podcast about learning to lead in the multi-ethnic church.
Have mercy.
Aprendiendo a liderar en la iglesia multiétnica.
Let me say it one more time. The Antioch Podcast.
A podcast ministry of Madison Church.
Oh, I got Jesus, yeah.
Hello. Welcome to the Antioch Podcast, a podcast about learning to lead in the multi-ethnic church. My name is Eric Nykamp. Racism is not, and never has been, a monolithic abstraction. It has roots, stories, and histories. Racism has a geographical signature because places shape the way racism is expressed and experienced. These signatures look different from place to place, in spite of some similar generalities. For example, racism in rural communities looks different than racism in suburban areas, which looks different from racism within cities because different types of people are attracted to all three of these kinds of living environments. The concerns of farmers are different from the concerns of people who commute to work, for example. Even today, racism is expressed in the northern United States in ways that differ from how it's expressed in the South or the West. And the history of racism also shows a distinct difference in how racism was expressed in large cities from its expression in secondary cities. The Antioch Podcast's home base is in Grand Rapids, Michigan, a city known for its furniture manufacturers, its churches, and its Christian colleges and publishing houses. Because this is our home city, we are going to take a series of episodes to explore how racism has been uniquely expressed and experienced in our city, a quote-unquote secondary city, using the book A City Within a City, The Black Freedom Struggle in Grand Rapids, Michigan, by Dr. Todd E. Robinson. Robinson's book does not begin with the history of how the land for this city was taken from the Council of the Three Fires by European immigrants during the Treaty of Chicago in 1821. We want to acknowledge that this, too, is part of the story of this land. Grand Rapids grew from a trading post on the Grand River to the second most populated city in the state. And this is the point where Robinson's book begins. His book tells the story of African Americans who began coming to this city between 1910 to 1940 as part of the first Great Migration, and how they continued to struggle to become free in this city. Idella Winfield was unable to join us for this roundtable discussion of Chapter 1, but Pastor Reggie Smith and I were able to sit down together and discuss this first chapter, entitled Rowing, Not Drifting. Let's go now and listen to this discussion. Well, thanks for meeting with me back here again. Mm-hmm. For those of you that weren't listening last time, we're going to be discussing the book A City Within a City, The Black Freedom Struggle in Grand Rapids, Michigan by Dr. Todd E. Robinson. And we're going to go chapter by chapter here. So this week's episode is on Chapter 1, Rowing, Not Drifting, the Black Organizational Reform Efforts Before World War II. Pastor Reggie, I'm just going to kick it off with you. You suggested that we do this book study, and I was really excited as soon as you said that. Why did you want to do this book?
You know, I had been a pastor in Grand Rapids for almost 20 years, and I'd come from Chicago, so I didn't know an awful lot about Grand Rapids. I knew that it was the second largest city in Michigan. I knew that there was a huge Dutch Calvinist population. I knew that there was a huge church presence here, but I didn't really know an awful lot about the African-American community in Grand Rapids. And coming from Chicago, I had certain expectations. I had certain views that I thought that this is how Black people operate everywhere. You know, coming from Chicago, from big cities, there was a large African-American population. There were quite a few of the staples of church and business and auxiliaries and cultural life that just exhilarate throughout the entire place of Chicago. And so those will happen in places such as Detroit and New York and Los Angeles and Kansas City and Milwaukee. And when I came to Grand Rapids, I didn't know an awful lot about how did people get here? How did Black people get here? What is their story? What is their history? How did they go about living life? And it was not until I got Todd Robinson's book that it gave me kind of an insight, like, wow, this is how Grand Rapids is. And given its kind of provincial, uptight, religious kind of life, and wondered why was Grand Rapids one of those cities, those smaller cities that had very different experiences in terms of how did they deal with oppression? How did they deal with racism? How did they deal with power structures that oppressed them? And Todd kind of walked me through the history of Black life in Grand Rapids, in one of these towns that I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And he helped me to kind of grasp, here's how power operates in Grand Rapids. Here's how politics operates in Grand Rapids. And here is how some of the amazing ways in which people found dignity and tried to make a life out of it, at the same time trying to fight racism in Grand Rapids, which is very unique than any other place that I've ever been in. And so Robinson gives us kind of this insight into how do we go about living life that is absolutely maddening, that can happen if we allow him to kind of be our guide, allow him to be the one who helps us to navigate the history, particularly the history of power and political power in the second largest city in Michigan. And he gets us there. And so I thought that this book was really eye-opening to me. Wow, this is how racism operates in Grand Rapids, that I had never, ever heard before. And also, if Black people who come from other big cities would find this book as like, wow, I need this book. And to help me to kind of make my way of understanding the political, cultural, and economic life that Black people had to live in order to find dignity and not allow themselves to be co-opted, but to live life with dignity. So this is why I picked this book.
So what were some of the things that you were seeing here in Grand Rapids that you had questions about that this book answered?
This book helped me to answer quite a few. Number one is, why did Black people even come to Grand Rapids? What was the purpose of why Black people came? And they came because they wanted jobs. They wanted a better life. They came from places in the South. They came from places in the North. And Grand Rapids had that kind of economic engine with the furniture and other industries, manufacturing, that they thought that, wow, I want a piece of that American experience, that American dream. Grand Rapids can be a place that happens. But when they got here, they found themselves in a very, very kind of house of mirrors, that they didn't look the part, they didn't understand the context, they didn't know about the culture, but they tried to understand it as best they could. And they kept running up against these roadblocks. And sure, they ran against these old racist blocks in all kinds of places, but it is highlighted and magnified in these smaller second-tier cities where there isn't an awful lot of help helping you to figure out, why does power operate this way? Todd helps us to pay attention to some of those heroes and sheroes who were there, you know, listening and writing diaries and hearing their voice of how they tried to carve out a life in the midst of just absolutely awful racism. Even the Klan was very prominent in Grand Rapids in the 1920s, and how they had to find a way in order to remain people of stature and honor and dignity even in the midst of that, and to resist sometimes very overt racism in order to preserve a place and a space for Black people.
I love how you keep saying this is a story of how power was used, the history of power in Grand Rapids. I'm just wondering, it sounds like you're saying that racism is different in Grand Rapids or in these second tier cities than it would be in, say, a larger city like a Chicago or a Detroit or a New York. How is it different?
It's different because when I was growing up in Chicago, when Martin Luther King was killed in 1968, my city of Chicago went up in flames. The entire west side of Chicago went up in flames. The entire south side went up in flames. There was an outcry of anger that created, yes, a lot of violence and a lot of destruction, but also at the same time, it really galvanized people to kind of come together with their lament, but also to begin to put things together, to build new structures, to build and to find a new vision of how do you now leverage political power in Chicago. And there is enough people in Chicago that you can begin to strategize, build on those institutions that have been there for years and decades and begin to now make strides where out of that came Harold Washington, who became the first African-American mayor in 1983. Whereas it's in Grand Rapids where there isn't that many African-Americans that live in Grand Rapids, and how they try to find their way politically in terms of how do I deal with overt racism that I've never seen before. Some of the people who are in Todd's book, which he maps out very wonderfully, is the social network.
Yeah.
And social networks are powerful, powerful entities that says who gets in and who doesn't get in. And a lot of that is done by ethnic groups. Two of the biggest ethnic groups that are in Grand Rapids were the Dutch and the Poles. And they had control over who got into the furniture manufacturing, who got into meatpacking, who got into politics. All of those things had gatekeepers. And what they found out is that they got shut out. They were shut out of all of those kinds of the things because there was a ethnic pecking system that existed. If you were an Italian, you were here. If you were Polish, you were here. If you were Dutch, you were a little bit further up. And so all these ethnic groups that were there before most African Americans around the turn of the century, late 19th century, early 20th century, they found themselves locked out. And so they had to develop their own entities, their own organizations, their own institutions, whether that was cleaning or whether that was taxis. They had to develop their own way of trying to make a life for themselves, and found themselves pretty much because being totally on the southeast side, that this is the only place that they can live. This is the only place that can work. This is the only place they can go to school. This is the only place in which they can have churches. This is the only place. And so they were kind of locked in by their spaces. Since 1930, those same spaces are still the same even today in 2018. Mm-hmm. And I think that Grand Rapids gives us kind of a microcosm of what happens in these second tier cities, these smaller cities, which don't get an awful lot of spotlight, like a Detroit or Chicago or Milwaukee or Kansas City. And yet Black life is still trying to make a life, even in the midst of power structures, white power structures that seem to want to control the movement and also the flourishing of Black life in those particular second tier cities.
So Dr. Robinson uses the phrase managerial racism to describe racism in Grand Rapids. Can you explain what that term means?
Robinson has done a great job of really putting his finger on how does racism operate in Grand Rapids? And he uses the term managerial racism. And managerial racism simply means this. It means that the Grand Rapids power structure, the white power structure around the early 20th century, wanted to manage how change happens in Grand Rapids.
You ready? Here we go.
One of the things that Robinson points out is that it was helpful in order for business and entrepreneurship and conservative politics to really thrive. And if we have that kind of system, then we can manage demographic change. We can have a control about how people live who are different than us. Mm-hmm. We can make sure that there will be no outbursts or violence that will happen. Everything will be funneled totally towards business. So as Calvin Coolidge said, the business of America is business. You can use the same analogy for Grand Rapids. The business of Grand Rapids is business. So everything is geared towards how do we make business conditions and help good working racial relations work towards that end. And so they want to make sure that Grand Rapids would not be one of these cities that would blow up like a Detroit or Milwaukee or New York or Miami. They would manage their racism so that there would not be any kind of uncontrolled, untamed political outrage that would get in the way of business in a business-friendly environment. And so you had business and government and culture and church all working together to make sure that kind of environment would be maintained.
So how would those different institutions work together to make sure that things kept going the way they were going?
Those institutions all work together in this way. As long as whites are still in power as the manager, city commissioners, the county, they help to make sure that politics would be controlled and that they would maintain always a patron-client relationship.
Yeah, talk about that. What does that mean?
Patron-client relationship is no different than what any social service would say. They would have a relationship with people who are in need. And this relationship is never about peers. It's never about equals. The patron is always the white person who holds the power, and the client is always the African-American who needs them. And as long as that kind of relationship, there's a power dynamic, right?
Yeah, dependency.
The power dynamic is, I'm up here and you're down here, and you need me, but I don't need you. And I don't ever want you to reach a level where there would be equity, where there would be equality. Because the moment that that happens, then I have to deal with you in a much more human kind of way. And that makes the relationship in terms of race relations a little bit more sticky. It makes it a little bit more complicated. And so managing your racism doesn't want the complication. It's interested in certainty. It's interested in conditions that are conducive for those who are in power. Church would maintain that same patron-client relationship. As people come into a church who are maybe in a changing neighborhood, which happened quite a bit in the early 20th century, where churches were beginning to change as white flight was happening. And now they're dealing with African Americans, and they want to deal with them as not people who would come to church on an equal basis, but they would come with some kind of pathology, some kind of problem in which they would be able to fix and would be able to manage that relationship in a way in which they would still be the one who would be seen as the savior, who would be seen as the one who has all the answers and all the resources. And when you maintain those kind of relationships, again, with segregation, and again, that's where power happens, because as long as resources are given, especially after World War II, those who came off the GI Bill, who were mostly whites, blacks did not get the GI Bill. And so when building expansion happens in Alger Park and all those other wonderful neighborhoods, they went to whites. They didn't go to black people. And so that continued even as the Grand Rapids continues to expand outside of its own borders and spills over into the suburbs of Wyoming and Granville. I always find it interesting that sidewalks were never along 28th Street for many, many years. And I think that was done for a purpose. It was done in order to maintain white spaces so that black people and other people can't get there and really downplay public transportation. Public transportation would not be available to go outside of those boundaries to those other places where there is job and economic resources that are there. And so we find that all of these entities are all working together in kind of a symbiotic symphony relationship to make sure that they would manage the demographic change and uncertainty and to make sure that those conditions would never change in order that it would maintain its power, that it would control its space, and that it would keep political repression and outrage at a minimum.
So the roots of this are in the early 20th century. Are there any stories from this book that really illustrate this point well?
There's one story in the book about the Key Theater. The Key Theater was a historical theater in which people of all colors could go there, except that when black people would pay their fare, which is the same as which they pay with whites, they had to go to the balcony. And it was wonderfully called the In Heaven.
Not in heaven.
Not in heaven.
In
heaven. There were members who said, this is wrong. I shouldn't have to be in the balcony. And began to galvanize and say that we should be able to sit anywhere that we want when we're paying the same amount of fare as for a ticket. And black people began to rise up against that. And the white resistance resisted that. But it was the continual saying that we deserve the same treatment as any other person. And to watch that cultural obstacle fall. And it shows that when black people, especially here in Grand Rapids, when they catch a vision for, they know what racism looks like. They know how to leverage it in order to change it. And that here are examples of people who are fighting for their dignity. They're pushing for their right to be equal people of value and leveraging also their own organizations such as the Grand Rapids NAACP that played a huge part in helping that to fall. Black people were able to organize and use their organization in order to not have the white power structure manage them, but rather say, we will be our own power structure. Mm-hmm. We come with votes. We come with resources. We come and we are demanding equality for everyone. And then to have that fall is an amazing story, which you will never find in any other book, given that Grand Rapids is not one of these cities in which you would hear stuff like this. But in these second tier cities, the same civil rights movement was also going on. But you don't hear an awful lot of that. And what Dr. Robertson helps us to do is to not focus so much on the big things, the big cities. But he says, why don't you pay attention to some of those second tier cities where the same civil rights movement was going on? Some of the same names that maybe are not as famous, some that you don't hear very often, but they were doing the exact same thing that King and Abernathy and all those other freedom fighters were doing during the exact same time.
Talk a little bit about the resistors that were a part of the Grand Rapids Social Club.
Oh, yeah. I like the one about Louise Gardner. It says that she provided helpfulness in study and sewing and general charity. And what I like about Louise is that she's like your grandmother. Mm-hmm. A grandmother who came from the South and who had kind of a stick-to-itiveness about her. She already knew that she was somebody before somebody told her that she was somebody and was able to come alongside of people and to build an organization such as the NAACP. And that becomes these stories where you would hear a Rosa Parks. Well, Louise was a Rosa Parks. Mm-hmm. She just didn't get a statue. and she didn't get on the nightly news. And how those kind of nameless people, hopefully no longer nameless, began to be models for others, for other young people who were under her, who saw her, who were around her, who began to get a vision that I don't have to take it. Yep. I can begin to see a vision that can be different than those who are now here and those who have gone before me. And that is a powerful witness. They bear witness to fighting for freedom and equality and liberty and justice. And you don't begin to change things unless you see it. I mean, I'm reminded of a story by Isabel Wilkerson, who wrote The Warmth of Other Suns. And she tells this story that in the South, black people couldn't pass white people on the road. And she's telling this to some young people. And the young people said, well, if it was me, I would just honk at them. And she tries to explain to them, you can't honk at white people because you cannot pass them. And they said, well, I would get out of the car and I would tell them that you need to speed up. And she again tried to explain, you have no idea how power works in the South. And I think that's kind of an analogy of what someone like Louise is saying. We have no idea how power works in Grand Rapids. We really take for granted that a lot of these people who are in this book, who fought and who marched and who resisted, we have no idea the tremendous amount of resistance that they took day after day after day. And we stand on their shoulders. And I think for a lot of young people, I would say that this is the book that you need to read if you want to understand why Grand Rapids is making progress the way that it is, given that it is not perfect, even though that we still have police community relationships that are not the best. But we have come a long way from the 1900s, the 1910s, the 1920s, when we had to sit in the balcony to watch a movie and did not have the same privilege as other whites who were able to sit on the main floor. We need to begin to educate ourselves about the history of our own city, this furniture city, about why did these people like Louise and Milo Brown and Mrs. Clayton, why do we honor them? We honor them because they were the first to begin to break those barriers in which we stand on their shoulders. And I am so grateful and I'm humbled by being able to know these people, even though I didn't know them personally, but to know them through these stories and Dr. Robinson's book. They are our freedom fighters.
Mm-hmm. So we've just been talking about managerial racism in the early 20th century. Do you see echoes of managerial racism here now in the 21st century?
I think we do. I think we see that in terms of the proliferation of nonprofit organizations. It's in terms of its size and population. And why is that? It's because through philanthropic donations and money given from very prominent families, you know, bless their hearts. But again, this becomes a process of managerial racism. How do you manage to take care of people and you still stay in power? And that comes up as now that that money flows to all of these kinds of nonprofits, it still keeps black people in a patron-client relationship. Mm-hmm. And they get money based on not what we do well, but how bad we are. Again, going back to that same pathology perspective. And we have to kind of, well, how do you say no to money? Mm-hmm. You say no. And knowing that you have to be able to change the relationship between power and resistance. And resistance doesn't come if you keep taking the money. We have to develop our own resources, our own institutions, our own way in which there is racial uplift, building our own organizations. And that is happening, as Todd talks about in this book, from the Urban League to the NAACP and to other auxiliaries that came out of historical Black churches. Mm-hmm. Those are the ways in which you resist being managed by power people and structures to say, we're the ones who tell you how to live. We're the ones who take care of you. We have to be able to flip that script and say, oh no, no. When it comes to equality and racism, we need to rise up against it and to fight it. And even if it comes to a point where we have to resist and to be outraged, that is still a response. The Psalms are full of outrage and lament. David was able to share his heart and say, I don't like this. This is unfair. This is not right. And the Bible is filled of those kinds of resistant moments, mm-hmm, in which he says, my enemies are trying to take me down. And I think that that same is for us as we're doing this work and as Black people are trying to rise to all of the higher echelons of power here in Grand Rapids, whether that's politically, economically, religiously. We have to begin to do those kinds of things in which we begin to break the ceiling, to break the philanthropic ceiling, to say that we are people of worth and value and that you cannot manage our humanity. Mm-hmm. We are people of the living God, and we have a vibrant living relationship with the Lord, and we believe that God is bigger than your money and your managerial racism, and we will overcome that through his power. And so we're trying to set this new vision of saying that, you know, God has more money than Van Andel or DeVos or Pew. And if it is in his will, he will give that to us because he wants us to dignify him as he has given us dignity. And I think that's part of the continual freedom fight we're trying to do as Black people, especially here in Grand Rapids, to say we will not be managed. We will resist the patron-client relationship at all points until you recognize us as equal partners. We will not settle for anything less than that.
I think if most of someone's energy is going into not biting the hand that feeds them, you know, when sometimes you're feeling like, actually, if I really loved you, I would try to talk to you about the error of your ways. But if I talk to you about it, you're going to get mad and, you know, there's going to be hell to pay.
Mm-hmm.
That's not an equal relationship.
That's not an equal relationship. Something has to change. I love that when Jesus says, and after he's been with the disciples for a while, and he says, I no longer call you servants. A servant is talking about a power relationship that says, I'm the master and you are the servant. And I think that in terms of managerial racism, that's what we're talking about. They are the masters, the white power structure. Black people are the servants. And Jesus really does something really remarkable. I now call you friends. Mm-hmm. He comes down. He gives away his power and says, you're on an equal level with me. Yes, I am your master and Lord, but you are my friends. He is calling for an intimate relationship with now the disciples. That's a game changer. When we begin to embody the Philippians 2 model, that we're not trying to grab for power, but rather that we release, we let go, because it's really not about our money, our power, our privilege, our influence. It's really about how do we begin to build a community that is inclusive? How do we begin to build a community that's not based on power plays? How do we begin a community that is not about crabs grabbing each other in the bucket and trying to use people? And what Todd really lays out in the book quite well is managerial racism is at its very worst when we are using people for our own means, when we are using people for political power, when we are using people for economic gain, when we are using people in order that we may grab resources before they can, when we try to say that the best schools are for us and the worst schools are for them, when we say that the best land is for us and the worst land is for them, when we say that the best churches are for us and the worst churches are for them, when we began to see people in transactional relationships, something happens. We start dehumanizing people. And when you start to dehumanize people, they're no longer people anymore. And when they're no longer people anymore, you can do whatever you want with them. They're just another commodity to be used and consumed. And something begins to happen to the person who does that. Their soul begins to corrode. Their soul begins to shrink. And I think we don't realize what it does to our souls. What it does is that it shrinks it. It turns into the Grinch's heart. We begin to get smaller. And then we begin to see everything as small. And when everything is small, then it becomes competition. And when we are in competition for power and resources, then we're able to make a very easy jump to destroy people. And I wonder, what Robinson is showing us in some of these stories is how these freedom fighters who were humble and courageous people, they show us how they grew their soul, even at the expense of overt and awful racism at the hands of well-meaning and sometimes even not so well-meaning white power structures. But they didn't allow their soul to become dark. They didn't allow their souls to become hardened. They didn't allow their spirit to be dwindled at that. I think that's something that we can learn from them that I think would be so helpful for us to expand, to get a bigger vision beyond managerial racism. How do we enter into a place of really democracy? Of give and take, that there's enough at the table. There's enough room for everybody. We don't have to fight for every crumb, but nor do we have to fight for every resource. There's enough at the table.
Have you seen managerial racism impacting churches in Grand Rapids?
Yes, I have. As a pastor for 20 years, I've watched numerous times in which managerial racism reared his ugly head from an elder who says we need to not allow the church kids and the community kids to play together. Because the moment that we do that, they will infiltrate us. They will taint us. This is a white elder who said this. And it was the most stupidest thing I had ever heard. I said, what do you mean by that? Well, those kinds of kids, those community kids who are mostly Black and Hispanic, they curse. They come from bad homes, and they're not the same as us. I said, wow, that's interesting, because you're saying the same thing about me, because I live in this neighborhood. Well, no, you're different. Oh, am I really that different? No, I'm not. I'm not really that different. But he was making a prejudgment that he had to build this line, this wall, that there needs to be one for community kids who were mostly Black and Hispanic and one for the church kids who were mostly white. And children's ministry in my context became one of those kind of third rails in which it became very volatile in my church over the years. And I watched people turn nasty. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. And I wondered out loud, wow, Lord, do they know what they're doing? Do they know what they're saying? And the word that kept coming up for me is fear. Mm-hmm. They were afraid that they would be infected, like the plague or some cancer pathogen, or that their children would become worse by being playing and living life together as a community. And I came away with that to actually live this kind of life, you have to really be courageous. It's really not for punks. is really not for wimps. And managerial racism, especially as it manifests itself in churches, is probably the thing that most happens in most churches that finds themselves in racially changing neighborhoods, or they want to reach out in terms of that new community that is there. They're no different than what Todd is talking about. They want to manage the racism. They want to manage the conditions. They want to make them so safe for themselves that nothing can go wrong. And that's impossible to do. And yet we try again to do it because of our own anxiety, our own fear to control the conditions of demographic change, and believe that we can do that if we just have the right tools and the right knowledge to make that happen.
You've been listening to the Antioch Podcast. Worship well together.
This concludes our broadcast day.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Goodbye. And God bless you.
Thank you so much.
Antioch Podcast listeners, we'd love to stay in touch. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, as well as on the web at www.antiochpodcast.org. Please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please rate and review us. Positive reviews help others find us when looking for quality podcasts. And now, for our regular post-podcast disclaimer.
You have been listening to the Antioch Podcast. The opinions expressed on the Antioch Podcast are not the official views of Madison Church, its leadership, or the denomination of the Christian Reformed Church. Madison Church is a member of the Christian Reformed Church and adheres to its doctrinal standards. The purpose of this podcast is to provide recorded examples of the kinds of conversations which we believe churches need to have in an increasingly diverse world. These kinds of conversations pave the way for a multi-ethnic congregation to design worship services with unity and justice, and truly worship God diversely together. Thanks for listening. Bye!